It's the tip of the spear in the epic battle to defend the United States of America. The National Security Hour exposes the wolves in sheep's clothing and their nefarious plots to undermine and destroy U.S. national security.
Welcome, everyone. This is Carl Rettjohn on the National Security Hour for America Out Loud News Network. And I've got an absolutely special show for you today. A long-term colleague and friend, Herm Haskam, we've worked together over the years, going a long ways back, and it's just great to get to know him again. And Herm has just an absolutely Herm is just a great American and just has a great record. So Herm, welcome to the show, and it's just great to have you on.
Well, thank you, appreciate it. Looking forward to it.
Well, Herm, I mean, you have an absolutely incredible bio, and I mean, I'm not kidding here. You have really been a great contributor to keeping America safe in some of the most special and trusted roles. So Herm, please tell everybody, I like first time guests to give us the long story on your journey to where you are today. So please, Herm, take it away.
Sure, I'd love to. Well, I'd like to say that this is I've had friends tell me the same thing. This could be made into a movie in some respects, where you've got someone who is a first person witness to history across, you know, multiple different deployments and opportunities that I've had in my life. But I really need to start with the beginning. I'm an Army brat. I was born and raised on Fort Bragg, North Carolina. My dad was a special forces officer, served two tours in Vietnam with MACV SOG, came back from that, and we moved to Fort Devens, Massachusetts, where he was in 10th Special Forces Group. It was around the same time of the Iranian hostage situation. And, I bring that up since the anniversary was just marked a few days ago. And immediately after that, some of my friends in school started disappearing as their fathers were being recruited to go over and work in Delta Force. And, I was just intrigued by all of that and just what Special Forces always brought, you know, to the battlefield. The individuals I was fortunate to be around and their children as well. My dad retired. We moved to Wisconsin. And in ninth grade, my freshman year, all I wanted to do was focus on being in the military. So, started working on grades, working on athletics, working in the community, doing whatever I could to bring up that really great resume, and submitted a packet to West Point. I was fortunate to attend West Point Prep, but unfortunately I got injured. So I took a four-year ROTC scholarship instead to Texas A&M University. I had the great privilege of trying out as a walk-on for the football team. But I have to admit also, I did that because I showed up for summer school, found out, much to my horror, there was a 6-week break between the end of summer school and the beginning of the fall semester. So as a poor, hungry, and homeless guy, I found out, hey, out for the football team, you get free room and board. So I was like, I'm in. So I tried out for the team, and, you know, much like Rudy or Mark Wahlberg in the other movie, Invincible, I was able to run pretty fast. Caught the attention of the coaches, made the team. But I realized, too, I was not going to get drafted in the NFL. I was going to be a first-round draft choice in the Army. So I quit playing football and focused on ROTC, graduated, got commissioned, and my first assignment was Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I just happened to be there, and again, just like I said, first person witness to history, happened to be there when we almost went into Haiti in 87, 88, and 89. I was there for Operation Just Cause when we went into Panama. Was there for Desert Shield, Desert Storm. Rotated out of that and found myself in Hawaii and wound up in a strategic signals intelligence organization, which really came to a shock to me since, as I mentioned, I graduated high school from a small public school education, you know, with little math background, found myself doing some pretty advanced stuff, but was good enough at it that I got offered an opportunity to go to the National Security Agency and serve in a 3-year internship program sponsored by the director of the National Security Agency. That turned out to be just a phenomenal experience. Happened to be on the floor, on the watch floor when Scott O'Grady got shot down over Bosnia, was with the team that helped found him. Realized, you know, after that, after a multitude of congressional hearings that my boss had to attend, and I was helping him put the briefings together, that a lot of the signals intelligence equipment we had in Europe was really not designed to go after advanced signals. So NSA went into a crash program to build a whole new suite of equipment, but someone had to go into Bosnia to actually emplace the equipment. Well, it wasn't so much NSA engineers as it was the SOF community. So I got voluntold to go out to, as many of us always do, but I was more than happy to head out there to coordinate the installation of this gear with the SOF community. I caught the attention of one of the organizations and got a mysterious call one day, asking if I'd be interested to come to an undisclosed location on the Eastern Seaboard for a physical fitness test, a battery of psychological tests, and an interview. So I found myself reassigned back to Fort Bragg and stayed in the SOF community for the bulk of my career after that. I went to school for 1 year, Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, for Command and General Staff College. Showed back up on the eastern coast in the DC area in July of 2001. 9/11 kicked off, and I was basically on the road for 6 years after that in two different special mission units. And then I got a call to meet General McChrystal in the Middle East for an interview, and I got reassigned as the very first Joint Special Operations Command LNO or JSOC LNO to the National Security Agency. So I was the go-between for him and General Alexander as the director of NSA. If you read General McChrystal's books, My Share of the Task and Team of Teams, he makes multiple mentions of the Joint Interagency Task Force and some of the work that was done to leverage national intelligence community assets to assist the tactical warfighter on the ground, which we were very, very successful in doing.
Was this the high value targeting process? I mean, is this what that was in support of with McChrystal?
That's correct. So I was fortunate again to be a first person witness and you know, participant in developing the fine fix finish targeting cycle. You know, at that time, although I was on calls with him quite often, I worked directly for Colonel Mike Flynn, who was the JSOC J2 at the time. And my job was just basically to keep the command informed of new technological advancements that the agency or the IC or national labs were working on, assess them for their application downrange in any type of targeting missions, and then start the implementation process of getting those things out the door. And, you know, one of the things McChrystal brings up in his book is using that F3 EAD process that we had come up with, adding the exploit, analyze, and disseminate features later on as this was getting perfected, we were incredibly successful moving from 1 to 2 missions a night to doing 10 and flexing to 2 more on any given evening, period of darkness. So the command was really, really efficient at doing that. Being able to get mentored, coached, and taught by the nation's finest officers, I think we've had since, you know, the World War II generation, just was an absolute privilege to be a part of that. It was, unfortunately, it was time for me to go after about 22 years. I served as a contractor for a year, absolutely miserable at doing it, but got called one day and was asked by Admiral McCraven and Conrad Troutman, who served as the SOCOM J2, if I was interested in establishing the SOCOM support office up at NSA. So I was the very first director of the SOCOM cryptologic office, had direct access to the director, who later also became the commander of U.S. Cyber Command. So I happened to be at the, you know, ground floor establishment of U.S. Cyber Command, and learned very quickly that there should have been more collaboration between Cyber Command, NSA, and U.S. SOCOM because of their global presence and their access around the globe to start leveraging the capabilities that each had to literally to present day. So I did that for about 8 years. I served in Cyber Command for 2 years to include being the director of the exercises and training. Actually conducted some of the largest cyber warfare exercises, built the scenarios, real world threats, really made them complex cascading exercises for the cyber teams to have to, you know, dive into and resolve. In November of 2016, I got contacted by some friends who had asked me to assist them with some other things. So I departed federal service and joined a very small startup cyber company that did or manufactured very small handheld body-worn or vehicle-mounted devices to conduct cyber-related or electronic warfare-related reconnaissance and surveillance. That company took off about after 4 years and was acquired last year. And since then, I've gone back to my roots of being a consultant and advisor, specifically to small businesses that are focused on providing capability to either Cyber Command or to US SOCOM. And in my free time, I'm a member of a couple of nonprofits, to include one called Veterans on Duty. Veterans on Duty is committed to bringing more veterans into Congress, both on the House and the Senate side. I've worked in one nonprofit that was kind of like a research effort examining the roles of women in combat, and a third that was specifically designed to conduct research, and we'll call it alternative means of research and treatment on traumatic brain injuries to special operations soldiers. So, you know, trying to give back in areas where I think I can, you know, offer services as a tech scout to find those capabilities that either a nonprofit research organization is looking for to benefit the soft community, or technologies that small businesses have that soft community may in fact be interested in.
Wow. Well, Herm, I mean, I jotted down several questions because, I mean, you, again, what an incredible career, and thank you so much for your service and everything you've done. It's been great working with you over the years. How did you, And we got, let me see, about 4 minutes left in this segment here. Now, Jen Easterly, who's now the director of DHS CISA. Now, was she involved in this whole process? I mean, was she
When you say process, so just for some background, I've known Jennifer Cook since she was a U.S. Army when I was a major. We were assigned to Fort Bragg at the same time. Brilliant young lady back then, and then we were assigned again when I was in Fort Meade from 2003 to 2007. She was actually working directly for General Alexander and General Petraeus. She actually did deploy out forward and worked as the rep from NSA to CENTCOM when General Petraeus was in charge, and started getting heavily involved, moving so a little bit out of the SIGINT community and into the cyber community until she left, retired. Worked on the White House staff, and then went up to J.P. Morgan, is now at CISA. So I followed her around and her career more out of curiosity than anything else over the past decade.
Well, she's one of the ones. We got two suits. We got Missouri, Louisiana versus the Biden team, and I believe she's actually named in that one. And then we also have the Texas versus State Department Global Engagement Center. So she did good things for national security in the past, and then the problem is she's now in a part of the team that looks like they were using some of these capabilities, maybe not in the best interests of the American constitutional system. What do you think? We got just a real quick, maybe a minute here. McChrystal, in advance of the 2020 election, made some comments that really got my attention. And he's saying, well, we're going to use some of our capabilities. And I'm not going to even name the names, but I know what he was talking about. And I'm going, well, what did he do? Did he walk out the door? We're going to use some of our capabilities to make sure Trump doesn't get elected. So in 30 seconds, what do you think?
So I believe the capabilities that he's referring to were capabilities that were dual use, part of FFRDCs, if you're familiar with that term. Either part of an FFRDC or a CRADA that was at a national lab that had dual use. It actually started in a lab, got used by academia, was brought back over, but had the ability to be utilized in a multitude of different pathways. I think the organization, in particular the DNC, most likely used his leverage and his influence to obtain those capabilities, and then he provided services as a as a senior advisor, from what I understand. Those are the dangers that we always face within, and I'll get into that in the second session here when we start talking about threats. But those are things that we have to be consciously and constantly mindful of, in particular defense of and I'll say the First, Second, and Fourth Amendment.
Well, thank you, Herm, and everyone. This is Colonel Rhett John, absolutely incredible American. Herm Haskin will be right back with a second segment on the National Security Hour for America Out Loud News Network.
You've all heard Dr. McCullough and others share over and over the value of keeping your sinuses cleansed. It's a smart move all year, but even more so when we're cooped up inside. It's not really open for debate any longer. Those that live smart and live well pay attention to nasal and oral hygiene. Cofix RX has just the tools for the job with our nasal and throat cleanse. Click the Cofix RX banner on AmericaOutloud.shop to get 20% off your entire order. That's right, AmericaOutloud.shop. Use coupon code OUTLOUD. That's coupon code OUTLOUD for 20% off your entire order.
Use Cofix RX because it works. 58 million people suffer from joint aches and stiffness in the U.S. every day. Ignoring chronic joint discomfort can affect mobility and your quality of life. Advanced Nutrition Company, Healthy Cell, created Joint Health and Mobility to support connective tissue, joint lubrication, and reduce joint irritation with curcumin, omega-3, chondroitin, glucosamine, and hyaluronic acid for joint comfort and flexible range of motion. And Healthy Cell's not a pill. It's a patent-pending gel you swallow with clinically proven ultra-absorption of science-backed ingredients. You would need to take 11 pills to get the same amount of nutrients in each gel pack. And these great-tasting gels come in a small packet. Tear off the top, shoot it down, or mix it in water. It's 100% drug-free joint support. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. HealthyCell.com, code OUTLOUD for 25% off.
We're back. This is Colonel Rhett John on the National Security Hour for America Out Loud News Network. And again, I have Herm Haskin, who is just has an incredible service to America and has just done so many wonderful things for America in uniform and as a civil servant and for America. So, Herm, what do you think about... I did the original 702 work in 2008. That was the mass surveillance. And, you know, at the time, I just didn't know any better. I mean, I wrote a lot of the stuff. It seemed like a good idea. And that was essentially collect everything, mask out American names. But what do you think about how the whole 702 thing has evolved? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I appreciate the question, and it is an incredibly complex answer that, you know, obviously is fraught with a whole bunch of legal language that goes along with it. But if we are to go back to our principles, you look at how civilians and military personnel are brought in and matriculate into the National Security Agency, several things are just drummed into your head, not just your oath of office, but in particular, the executive orders that govern what you do, the United States Signals Intelligence Directives, the USIDs that also govern specifically what you do. But there is always a component of privacy, of staying away and never violating the Fourth Amendment. And, you know, that becomes difficult when you start looking at, you know, the advent of global telecommunications and how switches work and where phone calls go and IP addresses and routers and all the other things that get mixed into there. And then having to explain some incredibly complex, you know, technical operations in the way in which sources and methods are leveraged to obtain the information you're looking for, and explain that to a lawyer that may have never been steeped in any kind of technology whatsoever. So we've always got a default back to the Fourth Amendment as our common denominator. I mean, it just absolutely has to be. And then you leverage the executive office, all the legal expertise and technical expertise that is brought to bear to determine how best can you do this with minimizing risk to national security, and particularly minimizing risk to the United States and obviously its allies as well. Having an appropriate auditing program in place to make sure that there are no violations and that your system is doing exactly as you designed it to be. The problem is from 2012, we'll say to present day, since the 702 just, you know, at first got killed off, and then Congress came back and, you know, made some changes to it and then reworked it to get it approved again, much to the credit of General Hawk's recent testimony before Congress. You now have a system in place that is struggling to keep pace. Because to your point, it's like, I want everything that there is, but it's almost impossible for the system to keep up. So you could have a significant backlog of data, have no idea that there may be a potential violation in the sea of data that you haven't even processed yet. But then someone comes in and says, you know, I'm doing a Freedom of Information Act. I demand that you release this information. I think I may have been, you know, surveilled. And the agency may not even know because they haven't even touched that massive amount of data yet. Then you got to go through the system to, you know, to clean it out. And the system works very, very well in terms of being able to mask individuals, mask the sources and methods as far as that's concerned, but you just don't have enough people. And I think, you know, we're going to have to start relying on much more precise, if not elegant, selection and filtering criteria as an AI model and start figuring out how we can do this more effectively to ensure we are, in fact, protecting the privacy of U.S. persons, number one. But then secondly, as guardrails for society, that there is a very stringent auditing process in place so that we don't have the violations that we've had in the past. And I mean, the ones that have been there that we know were used for political weaponization of this data absolutely should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
It was early 2016, because we would have these down at the Pentagon. We'd have these twice a week cyber meetings with everybody. And I used to be part of this thing called the Cyber Response Group that kind of, my portfolio kind of changed in about 2014. But I think it was also a strategic moving me out of there by the Obama team. They didn't want me around. But it was in early 2016, all of a sudden there was these Five Eyes partners have uncovered that the Russians are meddling in the election, and they sure are interested in this guy named Trump. And it was almost theatrical, and it was just abrupt. It was almost like it was planned or contrived, which I think, as we know now, it probably was planned, contrived as part of Fusion GPS and the whole fraud. But can we trust the general workforce? Do we still have enough white hats, white knights that will do the right thing? Or have we passed the tipping point? And I'm not even talking about the politicals. I'm not talking about the senior executives and uniform military, but I'm just talking about the general workforce. Have we passed the tipping point, or can we trust the general workforce inside the collection monster?
I think you can. I think there's still the majority of the individuals that are there are committed to the principles of the Constitution of the United States. You know, for years, unless someone was able to show me a specific individual who had violated and was still on the job, I had not yet in my 30 years of being in and out of Fort Meade, never as an employee, mind you, I was always there as a visitor, and I had access to basically any office that I needed access to. And if I didn't have access to it, I could get it through permission just by asking the right individuals. But at the heart of where all these operations take place, I had my own individuals that worked for me in U.S. Special Operations Command that worked in those organizations. Never saw anybody there ever violate anything. And if there was accidental or incidental collection, it was immediately taken care of. That doesn't mean that there are other organizations in and out of the federal government that don't have similar capability. And that's one thing that we have to be very mindful of. I mean, if you look at, for example, the federal government, and then we'll say in particular, the intelligence community and the reliance on commercial communications to get their message through or to pass collection, it's pretty substantial. And it requires global reach and global access. So that opens, you know, the federal government to a panoply, and I'll use that word, of deliberately of bad actors. And we have to, again, as much as we need guardrails on the 702 collection activity to ensure that there are no violations, we equally need something that is looking at external threats, not just internal threats. And I don't know if we have those in sufficient quantity. I know that that's probably a bridge too far for DHS CISA. But that's kind of where we're at right now.
Well, should we go back to warrants? I mean, should we? My vote was not to renew the 702. And I'd been through a number of congressional hearings when or a number of dog and pony shows where the 702 issue was in play. And I'd seen it several times when members of Congress, senior staff would be brought in and shown the capabilities. And every time, everybody there just was blown away and they say, yes, we got to do this. And I'm at the point where I'm going, no, I think we got to go back to individual. I'm really concerned that this mass collection, because actually in the DNI language, it does say compelled. The ISPs, internet service providers, they're compelled. So I'm quoting the briefing slides from DNI that's right on the public, you know, public facing slides about 702. And I'm going, I think we got a problem here. And you think, I mean, this was part of the war against Flynn. And you against a number of the other members of the Trump team, Kash Patel and others. So
I would offer this. Let me put it this way. I think any congressional testimony that is open on 702 and on DNI in particular is a waste of time. It is a dog and pony show, to be certain. Those presentations and briefings need to happen in a closed session, if not done outside of Congress at some offsite, with a very specific group of people that are dedicated to just going through what those activities look like, what are the current priorities, what threats they've identified as result. And I think to your point too, what threats have we averted or avoided by virtue of having 702 in place, to derive the data that we needed to actually make that kind of threat determination. That said, this goes back to the auditing piece, but the warrant piece too. I've seen in some cases, and this happened over a series of years. If you were to look at a FISA warrant, back when this all started, it was a couple of pages, just a few pages. By the time some of the, we rolled around through, let's say, post Bin Laden, 2010, 2012 timeframe, you may be looking at a 200-page, affidavit before the warrant is actually approved by the FISA court. So then the timeliness is missing there too, particularly if this is an emergent, target, emerging target that you got to go after. We also need to make sure that we are very clear in what those targets can be. Are you only after HVTs that pose an immediate national security threat to the United States? And if so, where does that fit? I can guarantee you never should that be a U.S. political candidate. Never. And I think we would all agree with that. That is a violation that requires someone to go to prison in the event that they were caught. Now, granted, some of the teams that were out there doing these things that did get caught were doing so under the direction of the federal government. So they wind up getting a get out of jail free card. That should never, ever happen.
Yeah. Now, Susan Rice was, I think in early 2016, personally, her and somebody else, I'm not going to mention their name, was really involved in the unmasking so they could see, you know, Papadopoulos and names and people like that. So unfortunately, we haven't had a chance to seek justice on that yet. But
justice will come at some point. And I think there has to be, in my mind, an independent auditing team that may in fact answer to Congress or answer to the National Security Advisor. That's actually where I think I would put it. Mm-hmm. Someone that goes in and does periodic checks of those databases, that they're the point of contact that all the reporting on auditing goes to, so that they can keep track of what's going on. Hey, if you got to do a surprise inspection, so be it. You do a surprise inspection, but there has to be a separate independent team that fully understands from the legal standpoint and the technical standpoint what 702 is designed to do, so they can monitor its progress and its success. And if need be, you know, its utility. If there is no utility for it anymore, then get rid of it.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Herm. Yeah, all these are good things. And ladies and gentlemen, this shows the complicated nature of this whole collection process. And we want the world's best intelligence, the world's best law enforcement, the world's best military to defend Americans. And this is one thing I always say, is you can have transparency and accountability even on compartmented operations. I think, Herm, what you've mentioned you've mentioned a robust independent audit capability, which I think is lacking. So those are all good points, and so great stuff. So Herm, we're at the end of this segment. This is just incredible. We're going to come back shortly with the final segment and talk about recommendations, the incoming administration. But in front of that, just kind of what are some of the emerging threats that we see right now? But ladies and gentlemen, this is Colonel Rhett John for the National Security Hour with special guest and friend Herm Haskin, and we'll be right back.
When God, through his grace and mercy, gave us free will of the people was to live freely. To that end, we fight for the liberty of all at a time when global tyranny threatens us as never before in mankind's history. This vision is manifest at AmericaOutloud.news, a site for all who cherish free will and freedom. Now is our time, my fellow Americans. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
The Wellness Company shares your values and fights for medical freedom. They put patients before profits and follow medical science, not political science like doctors on the left. Their chief medical board, which includes Dr. Peter McCullough, are the makers of the incredible American-made high-quality spike formula. If you worry about spike proteins, go to twc.health and use promo code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount. Once again, that's twc.health, promo code OUTLOUD.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Fight back with HealRight. Gilrite is a bar you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Take action today. Visit healright.com/outloud or americaoutloud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
We're back. This is Colonel Rhett John for the National Security Hour on America Out Loud News Network. And again, special friend Herm Haskin, just an American patriot, good friend, colleague. And we've been talking about a lot of the details of the whole collection process and how we can hold people accountable and things like that. But Herm, recently we have both Jen Easterly, FBI Director Wray, and how do you say, I don't even know the NSA, how do you pronounce his last name, H-A-U-G-H, General, how do you pronounce that?
He pronounces it Hawk, like the bird, Hawk.
Hawk.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know, I always thought the G-H was maybe silent. I don't think I've ever met the guy, he's somebody I don't believe I know, but so everybody's bouncing off the wall, you know, with Volt Typhoon. Now, part of my thesis on this is, General Hawk said several times, "Hey, they're preparing. China's preparing for war." And so, what do you see going on? And what should we be concerned about?
So, I always go back to my military intelligence training when I see things that are being presented to Congress in particular. It is not just to inform, it is to influence. And then you have to ask yourself, okay, what audience am I trying to influence? Am I trying to influence that staff so that I get additional budget? Am I trying to influence the local citizenry, so to speak, or we the people, so that they understand what's going on, or you're trying to give them a picture of what you think is going on, particularly when you start talking about threats. So, you know, I know that I listened to the last series of senior leaders that briefed on Volt Typhoon and briefed on the need for enhanced security measures. Obviously, that means more budget, but it also could mean, in some respects, looking to loosen up some of the regulations with regards to what we were previously talking about.
It's
also a public forum basically tell the Chinese that that we've put them on notice, and not just the Chinese, but I'll say communist Chinese, the government, but also the Russians, the Iranians, non-state actors and others that may in fact be out there that we're trying to communicate to. I mean, that's how I look at congressional testimony.
Yeah. I noticed, and having been through several of the major breaches over the years, you know, Volt Typhoon was announced in May of last year. And it was really originally just, Microsoft found something. And as soon as I heard this, I said, okay, here we go again. Major breach, you know, and Microsoft just didn't come out of thin air. There was definitely discussions behind the scenes between Microsoft and the U.S. government. But then things kind of went silent. But then in December, all three started bouncing off the wall on the topic and saying it was preparation for conflict. And we also have this, it was in the 2023 National Defense Authorization Act. It's called the 1088 exercise, where everybody was going to come together and war game Chinese moves on our, and then this is the language in the congressional language, is do a tabletop to understand what will China do to domestic critical infrastructure in case of conflict over Taiwan. And so I think it took a while to study what happened with Volt Typhoon, start doing some of the war gaming, and then by December, and it's been pretty much nonstop since December, between the three of them, they've been sounding the alarm bell. Does it look like China is placing malware in preparation for war? What do you think is going on?
So one of the, as we were going through, you know, kind of my career cycle, one of the things I don't know if I necessarily mentioned or failed to mention before is I previously served as the director of exercises and training at U.S. Cyber Command. I helped plan and execute the largest cyber warfare exercises the federal government conducts. That was in 2015, 2016 timeframe. You know, back then we were still building out our cyber protection teams at U.S. Cyber Command and trying to develop the skill sets and tradecraft they need in order to be successful at defending networks. During the cyber flag exercises in particular, we had participants from the White House on down. And we did tabletop exercises. If there's one thing, you know, I would want the American public to realize is we need to focus on STEM programs in high school and college. We need to get rid of these nonsense degrees in college and focus on getting people completely involved in cybersecurity. And why do I say that? Because this is not just the military or the government's responsibility to protect infrastructure. For example, if you look at power generation systems, east of the Mississippi, everything is privately owned. And what I mean by that is you got Exelon, Constellation Energy, Con Ed, all these different, you know, electric companies up and down the eastern seaboard. West of the Mississippi, primarily their municipalities like Pacific Natural Gas and Energy, all the other ones that are on the West Coast. We have a very broken national grid. There really isn't anything I would suggest as a national grid, no different than water filtration and water treatment systems, you know, service, in Ohio, service, you know, water that's, delivered to Louisiana, for example. Everything's very compartmented. Mm. So one, you know, as I look at this and I built these real world scenarios where I'd go in and do a massive cyber attack across multiple different sectors in our national critical infrastructure. And there's 16, now 17, I think, adding space. But you start building this complex series of cascading events, have the teams respond to them, and see whether or not what they did actually helped or made the situation worse. And then in some cases, you put in the system that they actually made it worse to see how the team and the team leader and the technicians are going to respond to that. What I found fascinating by doing this is we also brought in the public sector and the private sector, banking, water treatment, electricity generation, you know, companies, energy companies, things like that, banking. Each one of them handles those situations differently. You know, we try to ask, you know, hey, would you be willing to allow the National Guard cyber protection team in your state to assist you? Well, we got to talk to the lawyers before we do that. Some things first, profit in some cases comes first, but in other cases, there are companies completely dedicated to ensuring that the electricity is turned back on, that the water treatment system is turned back on, because they understand as well. And this is something for the next administration to think about, too, is we have got to make sure we're doing everything we can to grow confidence in the ability of the government to provide basic needs that the taxpayer expects. Law enforcement, health, you know, some of the obviously some other areas as well. But that's where I think if we're looking at some sort of cyber warfare design by communist China, it is their intention is to undermine our population's confidence in the government to provide them the basic services that they're looking for. Number one being protection. I mean, that's what we have a military for. That's why we have all these government services as well. That is an enormous task. Now, Christopher Wray, during his last testimony, brought up a very interesting point. Our cyber teams are outnumbered by Communist China, just Communist China, 50 to 1, 50 to 1.
Yeah, I was surprised at that number. I was always thinking like 1 to 10. I didn't know. No. It was 50 to 1. Wow.
So they just recently upgunned. Think about this. We basically created Cyber Command. The People's Liberation Army just announced the same thing, a reorganization of their strategic forces. So you have strategic rocket forces, ground forces, maritime forces. Now you have strategic cyber forces. And then under that, they have another clandestine group that goes out and really does the damage that the APTs, the persistent teams, advanced persistent teams are conducting, that we really have to be mindful of. Volt Typhoon, yeah, that, you know, that's one, but there are several other aspects that, while Volt Typhoon is important, it shouldn't overshadow what the rest of the nation state cyber teams are doing, not just in China, but in Russia, in Iran, in North Korea. I mean, North Korea has some of the best hackers in the world. So, and they're motivated, and they're each motivated for different reasons. So, you know, we certainly need to take a look at that. You know, I know this isn't part of the cyber discussion. I would be incredibly concerned about what's going on our southern border.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
With the amount of Chinese military age males, Chinese nationals that are coming in here, are they here for freedom, or are they here to conduct strategic reconnaissance on national critical infrastructure around the country? I think we really need to be focused on the latter, because if we're not imagining the unimaginable, we're not thinking. And I think that is an area that the next administration needs to seriously consider as they're starting to organize each of their, if you want to call them, specialty groups, one being national cybersecurity and strategy. If we're not diving in Manhattan Project-like into cybersecurity to protect our country's national critical infrastructure with the help of our private industry, we are not going to be successful across the board.
I just came from a national press club. It was about 2 weeks ago, but it was the Taiwanese were briefing on their elections, and something really caught my attention. And I was actually in Taiwan to cover the elections, but one thing I was very surprised that they went into detail was, although China tried to noodle with cyber, with TikTok, and influence the elections, they really stressed the role of the on-the-ground collaborator. And it makes sense. Because even if you have all these sophisticated techniques, and you know these things, you still need that set of eyes and ears on the ground to help you refine the message, be more accurate. Maybe you're hitting the wrong target, help you hit the right target. And that's, I think it's exactly what's going on with the Chinese special operators coming across the border, because you may have all these great remote access capabilities, but you still need those eyes and ears and maybe even muscle on the ground.
That is exactly the conversation I've had with customers in my consulting efforts that I've been having lately. Is if you look at, for example, Cyber Command is has now kicked off CyberCom 2.0. Mm-hmm. And General Hawk is specifically talking about expeditionary cyber. Why? Well, if you look at our national defense strategy, it talks about integrated deterrence. Well, that's not just Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines all working well together. It's fighting in all the domains, maritime, space, all the way through cyber. General Nakasone, before he left, used to talk about persistent engagement. And what that meant is, for deployed, in my mind, when you start talking expeditionary cyber, you're talking about being forward deployed in the area, as you just mentioned, in order to polish up that target, to be more precise, to actually either stay there or emplace items, sensors or whatever, to actually witness what you did to that target and report back how effective you were at actually going after that target. You need human beings to do that as much as you need technology and sensors to provide you that kind of data. I cannot imagine that the Chinese aren't thinking the same way, and that they have the ability with 1.4, 1.6 billion people to send quite a number across the border. Don't know if these guys are, you know, like we said, there are, I mentioned, they are military age males. We know that for the most part. We have no idea why they're here. We have no mechanism in place right now to monitor them. We just don't. The FBI is absolutely overwhelmed. You're really going to have to leave it to local sheriff's departments to keep an eye on how many people are showing up. Yeah. Where we start being worried is in the event they start showing up outside major military bases or major military support nodes. And I'm talking rail yards, airports, things like that. You know, if we start seeing people do that and they're sent there to collect information, no different than what you see in the movie Pearl Harbor, when the Chinese were sitting there talking to the barber, you know, and they're looking at what ships are in the harbor, you know, right prior to December 7th, 1941. We're in the same situation now. Yeah. You know, we've had senior White House cyber advisors in the past talk about a cyber Pearl Harbor. We may, in fact, be witnessing it and not realizing it in front of us.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, absolutely incredible stuff and important stuff. Hey, Herm, this show just blew by. This was so incredible talking with you about all these matters. We got about 30 seconds left. How do people get, I always like people to give their grid coordinates. You know, you were such a treasure trove of information and, you know, doing a lot of consulting and advising to companies. How do people get in contact with Herm Haskin?
Just go to Herm Haskin on LinkedIn, HermHaskin, and just hit me up on LinkedIn.
Okay, that's great. Oh, that's great. So, Herm, thank you so much. And this has just been incredible. We're going to be having you back soon. Thank you so much. And just appreciate all your service.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
And we'll be back with another episode of the National Security Hour with Colonel Rhett John on America Out Loud News Network.